Hi, Lee.
Hey, Bob.
How are you doing?
I'm doing okay.
Good. Let me introduce this. I'm Robert Wright. This is The Wright Show, available on both streaming video and via audio podcast. You are Lee McIntyre. You're a philosopher. In fact, you're a fellow at the Center for Philosophy and History of Science at Boston University. You've written a book we're going to talk about. It is called The Scientific Attitude, Defending Science from Denial, Fraud, and Pseudoscience. It looks like that. Podcast listeners can't see this, but others can. It's a very handsome jacket. It's published by MIT Press, very prestigious academic press. Now, there's a lot to talk about here. I mean, the subtitle gives you some sense of what this is about. But I think in setting up the conversation, is it fair to say that this is in some ways a logical successor to your previous book, which was called Post-Truth, which was about what is sometimes called the post-truth era, when, in your view, an alarming number of people believe things that are manifestly false? Is that?
It's a successor. I mean, it's almost sort of a prequel in a way. I was working on this book long before Post-Truth. And in fact, in Post-Truth, one of the claims that I made was that one of the roots of Post-Truth was science denial, that, you know, we had 60 or 70 years of science denial since the big tobacco thing in the 1950s. And then we ended up where we are because people said, hey, if you can deny the facts about tobacco or about climate change, you can deny the facts about anything.
Right. Okay. So that's what I meant, is that in your view, one, you know, part of the problem we face in mm-hmm. grappling with the post-truth era, if that's what it is that, you know, science does not in all quarters get the kind of respect you would like to see it get. There's a little bit of an irony in your argument, I think, in the sense that I guess it's an argument that science deserves our respect, but your perspective, you know, the basic framework, your philosophical framework, is that in some ways people exaggerate the kind of respect that science deserves or something. I mean, some people have a simple-minded idea of the scope of scientific authority and the, in a sense, the solidity of scientific authority, right?
Yeah. I mean, misunderstanding is not really a version of respect. I mean, I suppose there's a sense in which you could say that, you know, people have always sort of misunderstood what science was up to, but, you know, decades ago they used to respect it, but now they don't. I think some of that's due to the internet, the whole death of expertise thing that Tom Nichols talks about. I think that science has gotten caught up in that. But what I see coming from science deniers these days is not really a kind of respect. It's a sort of almost the opposite. It's almost a kind of a contempt born of people who think that, you know, they really know just as much as the scientists. And I think that's because they don't really understand what science is. They don't know what scientists are up to.
Okay, so before we get into your argument, and again, I mean, I think you there's two kinds of misconceptions that you attack in the course of the book. One is a naive faith in science, mm-hmm. and the other, or a faith that's grounded in a naive conception of what it is.
That's right.
And then the other is a lack of respect for science, and you want to clear up what the proper grounds are for respecting science. And in the course of that, you dispel some of the naive versions of faith in science.
Yeah, I would say. I think that's a good way to put it. I hadn't thought of it that way before, but I think you're right about that, because unless you really understand the proper grounding for science, you're not really understanding how to push back against science denial and such. I think that's right.
Okay. And before we get into the whole thing, let's list a few of the issues that you're concerned with at a practical level. I mean, people might guess that climate change is one. Mm-hmm. You think that too often the idea of human-caused climate change is dismissed unfairly. Creationism and you know, this idea of intelligent design, which is a kind of a version of creationism, I guess. I mean, flat earthism, mm-hmm. anti-vaxxism.
Yep.
You get into scientific fraud a little as well, but mainly you're concerned with, I guess, what you could call pseudoscience and kind of denialism. Is that?
That's right. Yep.
So why don't we start at the beginning with what you might consider some naive sources of faith in science. For example, there are people who think that science proves things, that there are theories that are proven, and I think you would agree that you should never use the word proof to describe a scientific finding or theory. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think that's one of the myths that people have about science, and they use that myth to have unreasonable expectations of what science can do. I think you can draw a straight line from that sort of a claim to the idea that, come back to me when it's settled science or when you've got more data, or the idea that evolution's just a theory. That's where that comes from.
Mm-hmm. So why is it that proof isn't a valid idea in the context of science, as opposed to, say, in the context of math? And here, I mean, maybe we should start with, go ahead and answer that, and then we'll get into.
Yeah, I mean, there's a something of a philosophical dispute about this, but I think it's fairly widely agreed in the philosophy of science that empirical evidence, empirical knowledge is gathered through inductive reasoning, where, you're not coming up with some logical syllogism where, it's an inescapable conclusion at the end, and, you're certain of the result because it was contained in the premises. With science, you're making something of a leap. It's an intelligent leap based on the evidence, based on the pattern that you see in the evidence, but it's always possible for it to be overturned later. The kind of move from Newton to Einstein, that's the sort of thing that's always waiting in the closet in science, is this idea that, when more evidence comes in, it will be possible that even the best corroborated theory will be overthrown. And that's, some people look at that as a weakness of science. I think of that as a strength of science, because it means that science is always open to learning more. It means that, scientists are open to new evidence, and they have to be skeptical and they have to test it, but they are always allowing for the idea that as more data come in, the picture will get clearer.
Mm-hmm. I mean, people may have heard that for a theory to be scientific, it should be falsifiable, and I think there's maybe some disagreement about it. You can probably find there are people who argue that that shouldn't be one of the criteria. But in any event, if you grant that it is, you can never be sure that you've thought of every test you could subject a theory to. There could be some way of falsifying it you haven't thought of, and there's no way, even in principle, to know you've subjected it to every test that could falsify a theory.
That's right. I mean, that's based on Hume's problem of induction and Karl Popper's idea of falsification. And I mean, Karl Popper is one of the giants in the philosophy of science. And I mean, some of what I say in the book, as I make clear, obviously is Popperian. I enjoy his philosophy, but I don't like to. My own view is that the distinction between science and non-science isn't a matter of logic. It's not a matter of method. It's a matter of attitude. So I really go back to something that Popper talks about early in his work, he talks about the critical attitude of science, which is kind of the foundation for his idea of falsification. But then in his zeal to take that critical attitude and make it into something perfect, make it into something that's razor sharp that he can use as a criteria of demarcation, he makes it a matter of logic. And this is when he says, no, science is actually deductive. It's actually there because there's a logical move you can make in deduction with falsification. And so that's something that Popper just sort of set the field on its ear for the last 100 years.
Now, did you say deductive?
Deduction, yes.
Where did Popper? Now, he's like early mid 20th century, early 20th century, I guess. One of the first, I think maybe the first kind of popularly famous almost philosophers of science.
Oh yes.
I mean, a lot of what people might learn in kind of high school about what science is comes from Popper. So where, yep. What did he say was deductive about? So, I mean, we've covered the inductive, the idea that, yeah. you know, you look around at, you see a lot of evidence and you kind of come up with a single principle that might explain it. That's induction. Where does Popper see the deduction coming in?
So this is one of the absolutely most clever moves I've ever seen a philosopher make. I mean, this was, you could make the argument, this is why I got into philosophy, because I read Popper's book, Conjectures and Refutations, when I was 19. And I just, that was it. I was going to become a philosopher of science after that. So he claims that he can solve not only the problem of demarcating science from non-science, but that he can really dissolve Hume's problem of induction. And he does it like this. So the simplest deductive argument is if P then Q and P therefore Q. So that's the, you know, a simple sort of a deductive argument. It's so famous. It's got a name, modus ponens. And it means that if the premises are true, then the conclusion's true. That's just what deduction means. Mm-hmm. And Popper was wrestling with this idea that, you know, everybody thought that science was based on induction. And he said, no, wait a minute. If it's based on induction, then that means that we've got this open-ended problem. We've got the idea that science can never be certain. And again, for him, that didn't seem rigorous enough. And so he looked at the logic a little bit more, and he realized that there was another deductively valid syllogism, which is related to the one that I just gave you, called modus tollens. And it goes like this. If P, then Q, not Q, therefore not P.
Right.
Now, that's beautiful, because that's deductively valid.
Right.
And so he founded his entire philosophy of science on the idea that what they were doing in science is saying, you know, if P, then Q, and then they would look for not Q. If they could find, if they could find a falsifying instance for any law,
okay,
then that law was overturned. And so, that was a way to get certainty in science. It's a beautiful, gorgeous idea, but I think that it pushes it too far, because there are several technical problems with that in relating it to science.
So just to briefly make it concrete, so it's like, if yeah. my theory is correct, then these two balls, though of different weights, will fall at the same velocity. If they don't fall at the same velocity, then my theory is false. If you accept that premise, then the conclusion follows, and that would be an example of falsification.
That's exactly right. Popper's great inspiration here was Einstein. Einstein making the prediction that, you know, if his theory of relativity was correct, you would be able to see light bend in mm-hmm. a strong gravitational field. So Eddington goes out, he does his experiment, and lo and behold, the light bent to the degree that Popper said it would. And somebody came up to him afterward and asked, you know, what would you have done if it hadn't bent? Well, he made a joke about it. He said, I would have felt sorry for the good Lord, because the theory's correct. But that's actually not a falsificationist thing. Popper wouldn't have liked that, because what he should have said, if he was a falsificationist, is then I would have had to give up my theory, because that's the idea. If you make this risky prediction and the mm-hmm. prediction isn't borne out, then the theory's wrong.
So Popper was right that any attempted falsification, including a successful falsification, is premised on deductive logic. But the problem is, the only thing you can ever be deductively sure of is that a theory is false, right? In other words, exactly. There's no application of deduction that allows right. you to say the theory is true.
That is exactly right. All that it allows you to do is to get rid of wrong theories. It doesn't allow you to say that any theory is right. Worse than that, Bob, worse. It doesn't allow you to build any warrant for your true theories. It doesn't allow you to say that because a theory has passed successive tests again and again and again, that it's more likely to be true. It just means that it survived to fight another day. This was a problem that Popper wrestled with his entire career. And he sort of
now, wait,
made
are
a
you
move
saying that you're
to solve it, but it didn't work.
Okay, so first let me get clear. So Popper really didn't get what I said, that like, okay, the fact that deduction enters into the falsification process doesn't mean we can ever have the confidence in a theory that a truly that deduction generally permits. He didn't get that?
Well, he did get it on one level, but then I think that what bothered him was that what that means is that you're not ever able to say that say, you know, because you've got this great scientific theory that survived all these tests, that makes it more likely to be true. And he wanted it to be true. He wanted that pattern of reasoning. Survive, therefore it's more likely to be true.
Well, but that's a different thing. You're saying that it's not valid to say that our confidence in the theory grows with the passing of each. You're saying that's not even valid. In other words, let's grant that it can't get beyond 99.99%, but you're saying that it's not necessarily the case that we can talk about the level of confidence growing as a theory survives successive tests.
That's right. So what you said before was that all we can ever do is show a theory's wrong, not show that it's right. And that's absolutely correct. And I think that Popper would have agreed with that. But then he wants to quibble a little bit because he wants to say, well, we can't show that it's correct, but we can have greater and greater and greater confidence that it's correct. But no, you can't. Problem of induction. You still can't do it. This goes straight back to David Hume. And this is all just this hell of an onion that philosophers of science have been taking apart for the last 100 years.
My intuition clashes with this notion. I mean, intuitively, I definitely want to believe that. And I mean, I'll give you, let's take the theory of evolution, which is interesting because it's a very unusual kind of science. Yep. In other words, it's an historical account of something that's already happened. It's not, so you can't just like repeat it and watch it the way you could say a process in physics.
That's right.
So you have these, you know, so you say, well, if the theory of, let's say sexual selection the theory as to why males seem to be less choosy about sex partners than females in most species. If the explanation is true, standard explanation is males can reproduce more often than females, then in those species where that is reversed, in other words, where females can reproduce more often than males, and there are such species, the females should be less choosy about mates than the males. Now, if you find one species in which that's true, you might say, okay, well, it survived that test. That's good. It seems to me if you keep finding additional species in which that is true, there is some sense in which your confidence should grow, even if you can't specify the quantity of the confidence, right?
And that's wrong. And it's wrong. And it's
this
wrong.
This is a really deep. This
it's
is
wrong
a deep
for a logical reason that drives me berserk. Okay. The reason it's wrong is this, because the sample that you have found is indefinably small compared to the infinity of possible samples that are out there. And this is what, so the probability that your theory is correct is undefined. This is the dark underbelly of the problem of induction. It undermines not just certainty, but also probability. And David Hume realized it, and it drove him mad, and it drives most philosophers of science mad, because what it means is that no matter how much evidence you get, it doesn't make your theory more likely to be true.
So in this case, let's just say, not to belabor this, but if we stipulated, if we imagined a universe where we knew everything about the sexual practices of every species, and we knew exactly how many species there were in which one thing was true and the other thing was true, and we examined all of the species and found it and complied entirely, at that point would David Hume say, well, yeah, but that's just all the species there are. For all you know, natural selection could continue and produce more. Is that kind of the logic of it?
I think the logic of it is that at that point, I mean, Hume has to say uncle, right? Because at that point, it's become deduction. At that point, you've looked at all the instances. It's not inductive anymore. You know, you've looked at every possible instance, right? Induction is when you're looking at a small sample and you're projecting a larger whole.
The idea of deduction,
you know, you've looked at all the small samples and you know what the law is, right? So but remember, if the universe is infinite in space and in time, you could never do what you're claiming, right? You could never say, you know, for all space, for all time, I'm sure that you know, light rays work like this, or that species work like this, et cetera, et cetera. I've got to say, this is why philosophers of science have been so unuseful to the scientists all these years, because they've been worrying about these kinds of logical problems. And I think that the real distinction between science and non-science doesn't have anything to do with logic. Popper was right. It has to do with the critical attitude. But you measure an attitude in a very different way than you measure deductive certainty. And it seems to me that that's really where philosophy has gotten off track, because we've been trying. I mean, Popper did his work in 1919. It's 2019. We've been trying for the last 100 years to solve the problem of demarcation, or the problem of induction. And I don't think either one should be solved.
We should say the problem of demarcation is being able to, with complete confidence, distinguish science from non-science, right?
That's
right. Non-science is pseudoscience, or it's just something that is in a different realm, like the humanities. And the problem of demarcation is being able to draw clear lines around science. And another thing you say in the book is you don't think that problem is soluble, right?
And I don't think that the scientific attitude solves it, and I don't think that it has to be solved, because the point is to, if you're interested in what's the essential feature of science, kind of the necessary condition of science, all you need is the critical attitude. There was a philosopher a few years back named Larry Loudon who made the claim that if you were going to solve the demarcation problem, you had to have both the necessary and the sufficient conditions for science. Well, that's incredible. That would be like saying that, you know, in order, you know, this all comes from signal detection theory. If you were going to look at planes coming over and you wanted to shoot down all and only enemy planes, and you wanted to let, you know, all of your friendly planes get through, you'd have to make no type one or type two errors for that to work. You couldn't shoot down a friendly plane, and you couldn't let an enemy plane get past. That's almost impossible to do, you know, to have a criteria that's that good. And this is why I make the claim in my book that philosophers really need to set that problem aside and figure out what's essential about science, because otherwise we're just going to keep spinning our wheels. I think at one point I may be the first philosopher to say it, I don't know, maybe in print. I said, to hell with the problem of induction, because I really don't think that solving these types of problems is going to help us with defining what's essential about science and using that to defend science against the science deniers.
Okay. So we should say, by way of foreshadowing, I don't want to turn to this right now, but the idea of your title, The Scientific Attitude, is that, you know, if we want to emphasize what is most distinctive about science, I mean, most importantly distinctive in a certain way, granted, your argument is that we can never say with 100% confidence, okay, that's science, that's not. But if we want to talk about what's really distinctively important about science and what it is about science that merits our respect and confidence, it is a matter of attitude more than a matter of method. Is that fair to say? I mean,
that's true.
Most people would say, look, if you want to know what's distinctive about science and why it's valid, talk about the scientific method. And you're saying, no, let's don't talk about the method. Let's talk about the attitude. As I said, that's foreshadowing. We will turn to that shortly. But just quickly, I want to say, I would think that if your view, and I gather this comports with the view of a lot of philosophers of science, is that more and more successful tests of a theory don't increase our confidence in the theory, I would think that this would put you in an awkward position when you're arguing with climate science deniers, right? Because my view about, like, if people ask me how I feel about climate science, I say, you know, honestly, I haven't looked into it, but there's all these people who make a living studying it. And although I'm trying to take into account the possibility that the field disproportionately attracts people who want to prove the theory, which is something we should maybe talk about, that can happen in a field. Or want to believe the idea of human caused climate change. Nonetheless, taking all that skepticism into account, seems to me I feel like I have more than 98% confidence that climate change exists and is human caused. A and B, if what it predicts is catastrophe, if you have 98% confidence a catastrophe is unfolding, you should do something. So that's all I need to know. Now that's my position. But now you're telling me that you, David Hume, and a number of really smart philosophers of science would stop me as soon as I said 98% or any number, or even said that as the years go by, we're more and more confident.
See, this is the problem. This is the problem with trying to found the difference between science and non-science on a logical basis, because you run smack into this problem of not being able to build up enough, not only to get certainty, but to get warrant for your theory. There are a couple of pages in the Scientific Attitude where I offer my own solution to this, and I call it the pragmatic vindication of warrant. So it's a little technical, but the idea is that we don't need to solve the logical problem. What we really need is to recognize that science is based on the idea of justification given the evidence, of the idea of warrant. And here's the thing. Is there anything that builds more warrant than building up positive instances? No, there's not. There's nothing better than that. So that's the best you can do. That's the only thing that you can rely on in building up warrant. It's a move that I borrowed from Hans Reichenbach, who made a similar move against the problem of induction, claiming that, look, yeah, induction isn't perfect, but if there's any regularity in the universe, induction's going to pick it up. So go ahead and use it. It's not vindicated. It's not validated. It's not perfect, but it's vindicated. It's the best you're going to do. I kind of feel the same way about warrant, about the problem that you just named. I think that, you're never going to get to 100% certainty, but what you are going to get to is the point where you can say, look, the evidence for climate change is now at the 5 sigma level. That means that there's a 1 out of 1 million chance that the science deniers are right.
Okay, but wait a second.
That's really overwhelming probability.
Okay, but that that seems to me in contradiction with what I had understood you to say before. No matter how many tests the theory passes, we can't specify a quantitative level of confidence. We can't even say our confidence is growing. So how can you say there's only a 1 in blank chance that they're wrong?
Well, right. Remember, the problem is there's a difference between Popper's theory and my theory. If you're trying to do what Popper's doing, and you're trying to found the difference between science and non-science on a logical basis, then you run smack into that problem that you just said. But if you give up the idea that you have to do that, that what you're trying to do is to found science on some sort of a deductive certainty or some logic or some methodology that's perfect, and it's instead founded on the idea of the scientific attitude, then you've relieved yourself of that burden, okay? And as I say in the book, of course positive instances count. Of course evidence counts. Of course building up more and more tests of a theory give the theory more warrant. That's just that's what I call the pragmatic vindication of warrant. It's this idea that, there's no better possible alternative to building up confidence for believing anything in the world. And so the issue is science equipped to do that? Yes, it is. And this is it's a vindication. It's not a validation. It's a vindication of the way that science works. So what I'm trying to do in the book, in the early part of the book, is not to get caught on the horns of all of these difficulties that philosophers of science have created for themselves over the last 100 years in trying to solve this problem. Instead, I've hived off the problem to make it one of talking about scientific values, to say, if you really want to defend science, look at how science actually works, the practices of science. It's based on this community ethos of theory testing, of data sharing, of replication. These are what really count. And those are all attitudinal matters. Popper discovered it. He should get credit. It actually goes back to Francis Bacon and maybe earlier. But this idea that what's distinctive about science is that they're open to new evidence. They're open to the idea that evidence can change their mind. And that's really the nugget of what Popper was after. And, if I'd been sitting where he was 100 years ago and I'd discovered this, great logical symmetry, maybe I would have gone with it and made a great career out of it. He did, and I have great respect for Popper. But I just think that he and the people who followed him are never going to solve this problem. And in continuing to try to solve this problem in the way that philosophers have done, we're continuing to make our efforts irrelevant to the mm-hmm. to the current battle that's going on in science, because the science deniers are out there, and you know, the barbarians at the gates, and the climate scientists and the others who really need the help are now reduced to saying things like, well, it's been proven, when it hasn't been proven. And then what happens? They get beat about the head and neck by the science deniers. So I'm trying to give scientists a way to embrace uncertainty and not be embarrassed by it, so that they can, you know, explain what probability is, explain the rigor of scientific testing, and that's a way to defend science.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm wondering if the debate between climate science believers and skeptics is really has as sophisticated an underpinning as you're giving it. I mean, I grant you that sometimes people say,
fair.
I mean, people say it's proven, and then the other people might be sophisticated enough to say, wait a second, no theory is ever proven. Okay, fine. But that's not nearly as subtle as what you said in debunking the idea that as a matter of formal logic, confidence doesn't grow with repeated testing.
No, you're right. And so I would be very impressed if a science denier made that argument. But the argument that they do make all the time in an unsophisticated way is prove it. Prove it.
Right.
So in November of 2018, I went to the Flat Earth International Conference. And all they could say was, can you prove that the Earth is round? Can you prove it? Can you prove it? Can you prove it? Anything you give them as evidence, they make the claim that, well, that's corrupted because the pictures from NASA are faked, or, you know, somebody fudged that data, or, you know, they've always got an excuse for that. So what they're doing is something, you know, very interesting. They're not allowing any evidence that you produce to, you know, help your theory, but they're also not looking at any counter evidence against their own theory. They're dismissing it all. So here's an example of some fairly unsophisticated reasoners who nonetheless think that, you know, they're the king because they're able to say prove it, and the scientists can't. So this is why they say climate science isn't settled science, or not all of the data are in, or when they say that evolution's just a theory. What they're really saying is prove it. And you're right, there's a whole technical backlog of why science can't prove it that maybe the science deniers aren't privy to, but all the philosophers who are just champing at the bit to, like Popper, to be able to say, I'll prove it, you know, I'll show you, because you want to put them in their place, can't be done.
Did Popper use the word prove?
I don't know. I mean, he may have. I'd have just searched the book to see if he used the word prove, but he did make the claim that with modus tollens, which is the if P then Q, not mm-hmm. Q therefore not P, that you could have deductive certainty in science. That was the logical model. Now again, he's not claiming that that's what scientists learned that and then did it in the lab. He's claiming that that's a sort of a philosophical rational reconstruction of the process of scientific reasoning, which is what philosophers do. And I guess, you know, I'm more interested. So I'm in the mud a little more, right? I'm mixing it up with the science deniers. I'm talking to them. I'm seeing what sorts of arguments they give us. And I'm trying to, you know, figure out how to push back against it. And part of the impetus to do that is just the idea that we're philosophers of science have done the same thing over and over again, and it just hasn't worked. And I think Loudon was right in one thing. If we were going to solve the problem of demarcation, we would have solved it by now.
Mm-hmm.
We're never going to solve that.
Can I take a brief detour and ask you? So you went to this convention of flat earthers.
Yeah.
Did you come away with any sociological observations? In other words, like, is there anything, what kinds of people are these? I mean, it's like, I've known creationists. I have relatives. You know, I mean, I was brought up among creationists, and I've met you know, kind of, you might say, high level sophisticated creationists. You know, people with PhDs in math who are into intelligent design and are doing these arcane and so on. But what flat earthers? I just never run into them, and so
well, they're all in one place. They're all at the Flat Earth International Conference. I shouldn't say that because they're also the Flat Earth Society, and they hate one another. It's different factions, but the group that I saw, like the People's Front,
talk about the narcissism of small differences. But go ahead.
That's right. So, I mean, the weird part is that they seemed like anyone else. They really, if you weren't talking about flat Earth, you would not have guessed that they were flat earthers. The one, I mean, sociologically, young, old, I didn't notice any political differences. I didn't notice gender differences. I mean, there were all sorts of people there. I mean, I saw a lot of black t-shirts. Sometimes it seemed a little bit like a Metallica concert, right? But it seemed, I did come away with some observations. One was that they were almost to a person conspiracy theorists. They almost all believed in chemtrails and trutherism about 9/11, et cetera, et cetera.
Huh.
So that was one kind of spooky thing. The other thing, just sort of demographically, I guess, that I noticed is that an overwhelming number of them were fundamentalist Christians.
Really? Now, well, I mean, that's not...
You know, if you believe in the literal truth of the Bible, you know, one guy told me that he was a flat earther because it was the only account that made sense of Noah's flood. Now, I want to be careful here because to say that most flat earthers are fundamentalist Christians doesn't mean that most fundamentalist Christians are flat earthers. Okay. So I'm not drawing any sort of equivalence between them. I'm merely making the sociological observation that of the people that I spoke to, quite a number of them were fundamentalist Christians.
That's interesting. So to make sure I understand a really important part of your argument before we move on, you're saying that as a matter of kind of formal logic, we can't say that as the theory passed more and more tests, our confidence in it grows, but you have a different way of getting to roughly what for practical purposes
That's
is
right.
the same conclusion.
That
we
is
We talk
correct.
About attitude and let go of formal logic, we have reason to believe that that indeed our confidence grows as theories get more and more rigorously and thoroughly tested.
That's right. And I mean, it's not in a way that you can prove it. It's, again, that pragmatic vindication I was talking about. Let me think of an analogy to help here, because the pragmatism can sometimes seem kind of slippery. I guess there's a difference between, imagine the difference between saying that you know that something is true and saying that you know something's true. Maybe you could do the first, but the second is much, much harder. Okay. So in a way, what the scientists are about is saying that they know that something's true. And what the philosophers have been insisting on is that they know that it's true, which is way too high of a bar for the scientists. That's a level of certainty that you're just never going to get with empirical reasoning. And so I'm trying to relieve scientists of that burden. One of the best pieces of philosophy I ever read in my life was by a philosopher at, I think it was either Oxford or Cambridge, I can't remember, named Hugh Mellor, M-E-L-L-O-R. And it's called the Pragmatism of Warrant, or the Vindication of Warrant, something like that. It was an address that he made, a speech that he made, in which he really compellingly made this argument about the importance of pragmatism in thinking about science. And I mean, I totally bought it. I after reading that, I thought, yes, he's right. It's not a matter of logic.
So are you in the pragmatic tradition in the sense of, you know, Charles Peirce, William James and all of that, or we're just using the word loosely now?
I'm using the word loosely because I mean, as much as I admire their work, I think that there's some baggage there that I don't necessarily want to own. But I'll probably at some point, my philosophical colleagues will want me to write on this a little bit more and clarify some of that. But for now, there are a couple of pages in Scientific Attitude where I do use the word pragmatic vindication, just in the same way that Reichenbach did about induction, to mm-hmm. because it allows me to make this move of saying, you know, look, I can't prove to you that science is gonna work in a way that leads you to deductive certainty. But what I can tell you is it's going to work if anything will. Mm-hmm. That the foundation for it, this idea of building up positive instances which lead to greater warrant, is the best that you're ever going to be able to do. There's no methodology. There's no competitor out there that's going to do any better than that. And so it's okay to bet on this one.
Okay. Now, so if what distinguishes science and if what warrants our confidence is the scientific attitude as opposed to the mm-hmm. scientific method, and mm-hmm. and maybe we'll get a little more into that, what the scientific method was thought to be later. But my first question is really, but isn't it the case that the people that you're worried about, the deniers, the flat earthers, the creationists, the climate change, you know, deniers or skeptics, whatever you want to call them, don't they all purport to have the scientific attitude? I mean, you said yourself, these flat earthers, what the flat earthers say is, oh, that evidence is fabricated. Well, you agree there's such thing as fabricated evidence. In other words, they say, look, we're open to evidence. It just so happens that all the evidence that contradicts our views is fabricated, but we're open to evidence.
No, you know, you're exactly right, and it's maddening because mm-hmm. when you're with them, they will claim that they're the real skeptics or that they're the better reasoners or they're the real scientists. And not just flat earthers, right? You hear Ted Cruz make the claim one time that I talk about in the book that, you know, well, scientists, you know, need to be open to new evidence and they're not really open on climate change, you know. So he cherry picks out 1998 when there was El Nino as, you know, well, that was a very warm year. Let's use that as our baseline. Well, gee, I guess it's wrong that the temperatures, global temperatures going up. So, you know, so he'll make that move. Other science deniers make that move as well. You're right. Science deniers often claim that they have the right attitude. In fact, a better attitude. This is why I gave my formal rendering of the scientific attitude two theses. First, you have to care about evidence. Now, again, science deniers will say they care about evidence, but here comes the second part. You have to be willing to allow evidence, new evidence, to change your mind. And that's where I got them. That's where the science deniers they don't have the scientific attitude. And I can give you an example, if you like, from somebody that I encountered at the Flat Earth Convention who more or less proved this to me, gave me a prime example of it. So, you know, I went into that conference understanding that I couldn't provide them with evidence. The evidence for flat earth has been around since Pythagoras, you know. I mean, 2,300 years of evidence and they still don't believe it. I'm not going to come in and pull a gyroscope out of my pocket and convince them. So I'm a philosopher. So I said, okay, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to use Popper's question. I'm going to say, what evidence would it take to convince you that you were wrong? And they couldn't do it. They couldn't answer that question. And I sat down with one guy, I bought him dinner and we sat down for 2 hours. And I went over everything with this guy, you know, every possible experiment we could do, rocket travel, everything. And we finally got to this. I said, look, you guys believe that Antarctica is not a continent. You think that Antarctica is an ice wall that spread out around the perimeter of the Earth, which means that we shouldn't be able to fly over Antarctica. And he said, that's right. And I said, why do I have this? And I pulled a schedule out of my pocket for a flight from Auckland, New Zealand to Santiago, Chile. And he said, well, have you been on that flight? And I said, no, let's go. I'll crowdfund this. I'll get my science buddies and we'll raise money and we'll go on this flight. And he said, okay, we can hold hands. You know, he was joking with me. I said, okay, let's do it. And then I said, okay, but let's agree in advance on a criteria because I don't want to get back from, you know, $8,000 trip and find out that, you know, you said, oh no, you know, there's the glass was curved and I couldn't see, you know, something like that. So I said, let's come up with a criteria. And I suggested this. If you think that the Antarctic is an ice wall, then it's tens of thousands of miles long. So we shouldn't be able to fly over it without refueling. But if I'm right, then we can fly over Antarctica and we won't refuel. And he shook hands on it and said, agreed. And I was thinking, oh boy, because I'm going to get you and, you know, Shermer and everybody else to contribute money to this, right? This is going to be the greatest thing ever. 2 minutes later, he backed out of it. He said that he didn't want to do it because he thought that the entire history of aviation might be a hoax to prove that planes needed to land to refuel, when in actual fact, a plane could go anywhere in the world on, you know, 1 gallon of fuel. And so I said, so what you're basically saying that it's just a giant conspiracy that started before either of us were born, against the day when you and I are now sitting here at the Flat Earth Convention having a conversation, and I'm about to use, you know, this criteria to prove to you that the Earth isn't flat. And he said, that's right. Now that was as clear as a bell to me that he didn't have the scientific attitude, because he was not willing to allow any experiment to change his mind.
Yeah, well, he was particularly creative in that regard, I would say. At the same time, I think you'll agree that to some extent, the cognitive mechanism that's in play in him is something we are all prey to, right? I mean, yes. We all get attached to our theories.
Oh, yes.
And we come up with reasons to dismiss, at first glance at least, evidence that seems to it's just automatic.
It's so human. It's so human. It's a cognitive bias. But here's the second thing that I have to make sure to say about the scientific attitude. The scientific attitude can't really be measured by somebody's attitude about themselves. It's demonstrated through their behavior. And as such, it's judged by other people. Okay. So in science, the scientific attitude is a community ethos, and it's measured by these practices of science that I talked about earlier. So that even if a scientist feels that he or she has a scientific attitude, they're really not the judge. It's the community. It's the practices of the community that's the judge of whether or not that person has it or not. But just imagine a scientist who tried to insulate his or her theory in the way that that flat earther did. They'd be drummed out of the profession.
Right.
But in flat earth, that's allowed. My friend Noretta Kurtka calls that a belief buddy. Okay. So in science, you use other people to test your theory, to keep you honest in a way. But in conspiracy theories, in science denial and pseudoscience, you want belief buddies. You want people to feed your confirmation bias, to tell you, oh yeah, that's right, that's right. All you want is positive evidence that your theory is correct, and you're never actually willing to test it.
But you do find in science, and maybe you'll say these people don't really have the scientific attitude, but you do have in science and certainly social science, maybe we'll get to your ideas about social science, but you find coalitions who adhere to theories, and they do give each other support in resisting evidence that is contrary. I mean, as you know, social psychology has undergone something of a crisis where they found that there were people who perhaps arguably were ideologically motivated, but for whatever reason, they were a little too quick to establish certain things about human psychology experimentally. And a number of them found support for these things, and they do form coalitions in a sense. And in fact, we've talked about Karl Popper, another giant, of course, in the philosophy of science is Thomas Kuhn. And I haven't read him. I don't know how. I think it would be pretty hard to read him, but I'm sure you have. But in any event, he is said to have said, you know, scientists never actually get convinced to abandon the paradigm. It's just they just die. A new generation of scientists sees the merit of the new paradigm, right?
Yeah, he's kind of famous for that idea as well as others. But no, that's an interesting idea. I mean, he's overstating it, but there's something to that. Look, there is a problem even for scientists, because scientists have cognitive bias like the rest of us. Mm-hmm. If you're not rigorous about the scientific attitude, if you're not rigorous about what counts as evidence and actually testing your theory, you can end up having ideological science. It happens a lot in the social sciences. And in fact, I wrote an earlier book called Dark Ages, where I made the argument that political ideology was doing that to the social sciences in the same way that religious ideology had corrupted the natural sciences before Galileo. That there was this sense in which it really should be a scandal in the social sciences that some studies of immigration show that immigrants are a net drag on the economy. Some show that they're a net gain, or that there are no really definitive studies on whether or not handguns deter crime, or on whether the death penalty deters murder, or, you know, all of these other things that are the, you know, these big, splashy, important things that you wish you had answers to. And there are right answers to these questions, but the social sciences just seem ill-equipped to find them.
Well, but also doesn't the subject matter pose unique challenges? I mean, you can't, yeah, ethical reasons or as a practical matter, you often can't do the controlled experiment, including with, yeah, many of those, with handgun, all of those, I would say.
No,
you can't do the controlled experiment. So what you can do is look at statistics and try to infer causality and try to dismiss possibly confounding variables, but as you know, you never know. You've neutralized every possibly confounding variable.
No, and that's fine to do that. But here's the thing that I think's missing in social science: if you know in advance how you want the data to come out, that's going to mess up the way that you do it.
Sure.
And you're right that if there are these big ideological groups, if there are factions, sometimes the overwhelming majority of the profession all want the data to show one thing, they're going to find it. I mean, that's how you're going to interpret. You've got these degrees of freedom in scientific work where, you know, you're able to favorably interpret the data. And I think that, you know, that happens in all science, but it's especially rampant in the social sciences. Now, look, one point that I make in the book is that you can get out of that, because medicine used to be in exactly that spot. But, you know, before the 1840s, medicine was not a science. Medicine had this problem of intuition and folk wisdom and, you know, thinking that because you wanted something to be true, it was true. Well, these days, clinical researchers and physicians have values. Of course, you know, health is better than disease and life is better than death, but they found a way not to let that mess up their studies through double-blind controlled experiments. Mm-hmm. So they embraced the scientific attitude, you know, round about the time that Semmelweis was, you know, doing his work on childbed fever and then Lister and, you know, Koch, all these other Pasteur, all these other giants in mid-19th century medicine started to embrace the scientific attitude and brought about a revolution. We need that revolution in the social sciences, because without that, I think we're just going to continue to have the sort of social science that we've had, which, again, we would never tolerate in the natural sciences.
Yeah, I mean, again, some of the questions are not amenable to controlled experimentation, but in the in social psychology, a lot of those, they were controlled experiments, and the problem was they were not being strict enough in the...
That's right.
In the methodology, and they were doing, you know, various.
Yeah. I mean, I did my dissertation on the methodological barriers to a science of human behavior, talked about complexity, openness, controlled experimentation, you know, all, you're right, those are all real barriers. But the real barrier is not having the scientific attitude. The real barrier is not being motivated to find a way to really hear what the data have to say to you. So, yes, you can't have a controlled experiment. They can't have a controlled experiment in astronomy either, or in much of geology, but they still find a way to learn from the data. So, I mean, you know, you're absolutely right that can be a problem, and, you know, complexity, that's a huge problem in the social sciences. But I think the real issue is, you know, are they working as hard as they can? I look at the example of Sheena Iyengar's work on the paradox of choice. She's done brilliant experimental work that was out there waiting for somebody to discover it, somebody to do it. But
Can you tell us what was the basic finding? Was this about having too much choice?
So, if you look at neoclassical economics or you look at social psychology, you know, back in the in the day. Social psychologists may be the exception because they actually did experiments. But, you know, if you look at economics, they have all these assumptions about perfect information, rationality, substitutability for the neoclassical model to work, for the math to work out. But it's not how it actually worked in the real world. Then comes behavioral economics, and they start to question these assumptions, do the experiments. And then Sheena Iyengar does this brilliant experiment, and I can't remember her colleague's name, but he did it too, where they found that although the neoclassical model says that people want more choice, I mean, who wouldn't? They actually don't. You can measure it statistically. You can find that when you give people more choice, they're less happy, and in fact, that they make worse choices. And in fact, the ultimate thing that you can measure is that if you give people too many choices, they buy less. She did her experiment with jams and found that if you gave people, you know, these huge displays of jam, they wouldn't buy as much jam as if you gave them a small display. Right. So, I mean, talk about the economic bottom line. And that was there for anybody to discover, but it was only when she took the when she embraced the scientific attitude, when she embraced the idea of experimentation in economics, you know, she and Dick Thaler and a number of other people, the famous folks, that they really made a leap forward.
Mm-hmm. So we talked a little about Popper, and I gather it's now pretty widely appreciated that his view had some shortcomings. I guess my question is, what's the closest to a consensus among modern philosophers of science about what the epistemological status of science actually is? I mean,
there isn't one.
There's no consensus at all.
There isn't one. And this is what got me so excited to write my book, because it seemed to me that, I mean, Loudon 30 years ago said the demarcation problem can't be solved. You know, in order to solve it, you'd have to find the necessary and sufficient conditions. Nobody's found those. Nobody could probably find those. And if we were going to find them, they would have found them by now. We're done. And that left the field in a very poor place. I'm not going to say that there hasn't been any good work done since then. But people stopped doing what they were doing, more or less, on that question, and really didn't come to a consensus. They did other important work in naturalism and underdetermination and, you know, the sociology of science, you know, interesting work, but they more or less stopped trying to solve that problem. Mm-hmm. And what I did was bring it back and say, you know what, Loudon is right. It can't be solved, but it doesn't matter, because the whole point of the demarcation problem was to defend what was special about science, and we can do that in another way.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, my view is certainly not the consensus view. It's too new, but I'm hoping to provide an alternative to the path that philosophers of science have been following. I mean, there are others who are trying to resurrect the demarcation problem and say that, no, it can be solved. I talk about them in the book. I don't think there's much promise there.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess one question I have is, you know, somewhat famously, postmodernism questioned the underpinnings of all kinds of knowledge, including scientific knowledge. It's generally been associated with the left. It's gotten a lot of pushback from people ranging from, I guess, Jordan Peterson to Steve Pinker and many others. I mean, on the spectrum of gravitas, I guess, when we were moving from Jordan Peterson to Steve Pinker. But, I guess to what extent were, and of course, you know, the postmodernists have been famously humiliated by that. Was a fake postmodernist paper submitted by Alan Sokol?
Sokol, yeah.
Long ago. This isn't the more recent example. This was years ago.
The one in the Science Wars in the 90s. Yeah, what happened is that all the postmodernist ideas about how there was no actual such thing as objective truth in a text or even in behavior, which is a kind of text, and this infusion of Foucault's infusion of politics into this, that, you know, well, if there was no such thing as truth, then the people who were saying that there was truth were really just political bullies. This all got transferred over to the sciences, where people started to say, you know, look, if all that's true, then scientists aren't really discovering truth. You know, we can apply all of this. I mean, it's not postmodernism per se, but it's an offshoot. It's this idea that, you know, we can question the objectivity, we can question the truth-finding ability of the science. This drove the scientists crazy because all of a sudden they were saying, well, not only are you not discovering truth, but you're political bullies. You know, you're just reflecting your own political beliefs and imposing them on other people. And so Sokol had the idea that he was going to write this paper that almost cursed there, which maybe I can't do on your TV show, but he was going to write this paper, which was completely made up. And he's a physicist, and I think it was called the Transgressive Theory of Quantum Gravity or something like that. Mm-hmm. And he was making all sorts of just outlandish claims about, I can't even recover them. They were so outlandish about how gravity was just a social construction and things like that. And then
He got it published
In Social Text, which is one of the most prestigious journals that existed. And then that sort of pulled the pants down and then led to what they call the science wars. So some people claim
that's finished. What discipline is the journal Social Text associated with? I mean, postmodernism isn't a discipline. What discipline did that journal say it was part of?
I don't know. Semiotics?
Yeah, I was going to guess
literary semiotics. Literary criticism? I don't know.
What I'm wondering is, is there, to some extent, was the postmodern critique, was it grounded to some extent on the kind of legitimate questions that serious philosophers of science raise about the epistemological underpinnings of science, or was it just more or less completely confused in your view?
I think it's completely confused, but where it came out of sociologically was, you know, after Kuhn, people started to say, well, you know, look, if all these sociological factors determine theory choice, if evidence doesn't completely determine theory choice, instead it's, you know, all these other social ideas, then doesn't that have this huge implication for whether science has actually got a foundation, for whether it's actually grounded objective knowledge? And they started to go into the lab and to study what this field of science studies was really started by Bruno Latour and others, you know, to ask, you know, can we study what scientists do, watch them, sort of like anthropologists going into their labs and then finding that, you know, no, they're violating all sorts of norms of logic and method that Popper and all these other people said that they followed. By the way, Kuhn was horrified by this. He said that this was, you know, a sort of a misuse of his work. But it all grew out of that. I'm going to say that most philosophers of science have great respect for science and were just a little bit put out by that. I mean, there's Feyerabend and other people who are kind of, you know, the firebrands who, you know, claim there is no method, there is no logic. It's, you know, it's all just opinion. But I don't know that last word. If he said it's all just opinion, but he said there was no method, no logic to science. It was just it was chaos for a while there in the field.
So my final question is about kinds of overconfidence that you sometimes see in scientists. This isn't mainly what your book is about, but I know you're aware of the issue. Mm-hmm. And there's a couple of categories. I mean, one is what's called naive realism, which you mentioned in the book at least, and that I don't think we need to get into that deeply, but so to speak, I mean either you get in deeply or you don't get in at all, but I mean I guess you would say, well, I mean, we could pause and just say that it is what the assumption that what your senses perceive is like exactly what's out there, right? Is that's
naive realism. Yeah. And you know, sometimes philosophers of science accuse scientists of being naive realists about the truth of their theories, claiming that, you know, they discover quarks because there are quarks. You know, they discover various things because they're real, and you know, so they're not allowing that, you know, maybe there are other ways of explaining the same data, or that there are sometimes theoretical entities that they're just using as a metaphor. Now, this has led to furious debate. I mean, if you want to know what the philosophy of science has been up to for the last 30 years, this is what they've been up to, is having debates over what's called realism versus anti-realism. And the realist claim is that the success of science suggests the reality of the things that it's proposing, that it would be a miracle if science worked as well as it did, if it weren't, if there weren't quarks, if there wasn't gravity, et cetera, et cetera. So even though these are, you know, invented theoretical entities, they must correspond to something actual in the universe, otherwise they wouldn't work. The anti-realists say, well, there are different types of anti-realists, but just to tweak it a little bit, the kind of anti-realist that I am says that that's nuts, because there are an infinite number of possible ways of connecting any finite number of data points. There are an infinite number of theories, and that just because your theory works doesn't mean that it's true. It means that it's well corroborated, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it's the best theory. So we'll go back to that pragmatism issue for a minute. Maybe it means that it's a good theory. Maybe it means it's the best one that you've got for now.
Right.
But it doesn't mean that it's true. And so, you know, you said overconfidence. I'd use the word hubris. It's the hubris of thinking that just because your theory works, that it's true. And I think that you can never get there. I think that there's always just that little bit of an edge over the horizon that you can't see, that suggests that your theory might not be true. Now, that might sound like a contradiction with what I said before about pragmatic vindication and warrant, but remember, I'm giving up the idea that scientists have to say that they know what they know, you know, that they have to be absolutely certain about it. But when philosophers come along and say, oh no, those theories are true, they're certain, they're guaranteed 100%, mm-hmm. given how well the theories have worked, that's where I check out. I don't think that you can necessarily know that a theory is true, because, again, there's always that more data over the horizon, which is exciting. It's what makes science so exciting. This is the part of the book that didn't get published. I had a whole chapter on it's called The Problem of Underdetermination. And I finally, for pity's sake, cut it, and I'm going to publish it as a separate article, because it was too much for a trade book. And but it's I think there is a contribution to be made there to the argument, but I'll make it separately some other time.
In other words, what we can say is things like, when we proceed on the assumptions that electrons do exist as we conceive of them, that does enable us to build these machines that successfully do these
right.
things. So in that sense, there must be something out there that, you know, bears a relationship to this thing. It's not
yes.
we're imagining
something
entirely. But as for whether electrons exist per se, quantum physics went on to give us reason to doubt that we had a clear
That's
idea
right.
of what an
exactly.
electron is.
And Einstein overcame Newton. I mean, we can have the best corroboration to think that something is true, and then that next little bit of evidence convinces us that there's an alternative way to explain it. I mean,
right.
Einstein and Newton both explained basically the same facts, but they did it in radically alternative ways. So was Newton's theory of gravity true? No, it wasn't true. And Einstein's may or may not be true. We don't know. What we can say is that, I mean, yes, I believe in, when I say I'm an anti-realist, I think there's reality. It's just that I'm an epistemological anti-realist. I don't think that the success of your theory gives you any certainty that you know reality. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of with Plato in the cave there. I think we're looking at the shadows and we don't know what it looks like outside the cave.
Okay, well, maybe that's a good enough place to end it. I mean, I was also going to ask you about scientism and the other form of hubris. If you have any quick examples of that, of people, in other words, scientists or science sympathizers of science who themselves have an
yeah.
exaggerated conception of the scope of the scope of
yeah.
science's authority.
It's a danger. I mean, I went to a conference one time on scientism, which was what convinced me to write The Scientific Attitude, because my paper was basically saying, you guys really think that scientism is our biggest problem? I mean, the science deniers are knocking down the doors, and you think that the biggest problem is people who are too confident in science? I mean, yes, yeah, scientism's a problem. I think it's arguably what led to that mistake I was talking about earlier with neoclassical economics, you know, the hubris of saying, well, just, you know, our models work so well because they look just like the models in physics. But that's, you know, if your scientism is this idea that, you know, you've got this methodology that works and you can apply it to anything, you know, you can apply science to ethics, you can apply science to whatever to religion. I think that's beyond the realm. I think that science works very well where it works, but there are some areas where maybe there's truth, maybe there's knowledge to be had, but you're not going to get it through empirical reasoning. And that's, you know, so I agree that scientism is a problem. I just have a real quarrel with the people who think that that's the main problem that we're facing these days.
But don't you think it can feed the problem you're concerned about? In other words, when Sam Harris comes out and says science can prove moral truths, maybe he didn't put it quite like that, but it was a quite naive, I think most philosophers would say, book about, it was called The Moral Landscape. And people are like, wait a second, now you're telling me to buy into science. I have to let you tell me what my most fundamental values are. I think that breeds a resistance to science.
I think you're right, but again, that's not resistance to science. That's resistance to scientism. I mean,
but it's easy for them to get.
So you're right.
I'm not sure they're always going to make that distinction. No, it encourages them to see science as the enemy, is what I mean.
I think you're right. I think that we have to acknowledge that there are limits on scientific knowledge, and one limit that I'd put on it is that it can't do what you just described, which is have a science of values. I'm not even sure how that would work because values are a normative matter. But I think
that's the problem.
When people talk about proof and certainty, you know, and something like that, I think we're in deep water.
Okay. Well, thank you for taking the time. So the book is The Scientific Attitude, Defending Science from Denial, Fraud, and Pseudoscience. We will link to it on the meaningoflife.tv website. And anyway, people can Google it. It looks like that. If you're imbibing this via video, very, very nice. Yeah. There's twin book plugs.
Twin book.
So thank you, Lee, and good luck with it, and keep up the good work.
Thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure to be on your program.
Same here.